Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Before bringing on our guest, Edward Herman, I want you to listen to this 3-minute piece of artwork about drones by Misty Rowan. Get ready.
So this one's called On Military Drones and Tearing Them to Pieces. It's the arms race of the future, really, except this time Sputnik's going to be an unmanned plane. And if the vessel is unmanned, doesn't that make the killing automatically inhumane? It's odd to me to think that when I'm voting with my dollar, I demand a better treatment of the chicken for my dinner than our military seems to see fit for the people on the ground in places like Iraq and Yemen, Afghanistan, or Pakistan. You know, those unreliable statistics, because really, who sees? The trouble with machines is that there's a lack of accountability. I want our government to have to make little stickers for all their little planes that say no dolphins or civilians were harmed in the making of this democracy. How about that? How about a harm-free approach to foreign policy? Can you install that, Uncle Sam, at the point of your gun? Of course not. It's an oxymoron. American the humanitarian. On a mission and it's called an invasion. Look up at the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, because it sure ain't Superman. It's a U.S. military drone and it's loaded, so go ahead and run, because it sees you too, but not with eyes, with orders. I mean, because anyway, that's what collateral damage is code for, dead people, lots of them children. Unarmed civilians is a way of saying that they had nothing to do with this conflict, but then neither do we, on this end. The taxed yet unrepresented majority of people in this country who do not like the war and do not support another one, but what can we do? We don't feel the trigger under our finger because we're fed a constant stream of lies, and all our lives we're told that it's do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, and yet every time the news breaks that a woman is raped, that a village was slaughtered, we are ready to make those sacrifices for what we call the safety of our country, and it is utter nonsense, okay? Violence begets violence. This is a fundamental truth. We are the purveyors of death and atrocity in these parts of the world, and then you wonder why they hate us? So you tell me, who is the real terrorist, the rebel with the gun or the smiling politician? Whatever gets the job done. And these days, the job is as easily done as the push of a button by some pimple-faced kid in a bunker in Nevada somewhere. Did you know that the controls for these drones are compatible with PlayStation? This is not a coincidence. They are spoon-feeding this to your kids, so I suggest you get acquainted, because drones are the future of warfare that already is. And I heard that Obama just okayed the use of drones over all U.S. airspace within the next year. So be prepared to see them around, equipped with cameras instead of bombs, so that should make us all feel safer. You know, they say that they are looking for the terrorists among us and looking at everyone, you know, just in case. Even though the only cases, it seems, that our government team can solve these days are the ones they cooked up in the first place. But hey, they gotta spend that budget some way, don't they? And did you know that it takes a whopping, jaw-dropping 300 people to fully operate one of these planes for just one day? One of these $28 million planes? Oh yes, sirree, it's a booming industry. You remember that bumper sticker about how great it'd be if schools had all the funding that they needed and the army had to hold a bake sale? People, this is what your government is busy buying. This is where your tax dollars go. So when they tell you they gotta cut some spending, you just tell them, land some drones, man. Just land the drones. And call me a sentimental hippie like that, but I believe in the power of the people to fight back, because we can't just let this technology run wild or go rogue or come crashing home on us, man. We must realize and regulate. We gotta study up and educate people before this whole thing gets out of control, with evidence to suggest that we are already at the threshold. So why don't you let your president, let your Congress members know what you think about these wars and what you think about these drones? Tell them, we don't need any more killing machines, all right? We got better ways to spend that money back home. Why don't you leave those kids in Pakistan alone? It's time to end the wars and land the drones.
That was Misty Rowan. You can find lots more of her work online. Also go to banweaponizeddrones.org and sign that petition and spread it around. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Edward Herman. Ed Herman is a professor emeritus of finance at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, where he gave courses in micro and macroeconomics and financial regulation for 30 years. He has a regular Fog Watch column in the monthly Z magazine. Among his numerous published books are The Political Economy of Human Rights with Noam Chomsky, Corporate Control, Corporate Power, Demonstration Elections, U.S. Staged Elections in the Dominican Republic, Vietnam, and El Salvador with Frank Broadhead, and Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media with Noam Chomsky. Ed Herman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Glad to be with you, David.
Thrilled to have you on. Should have had you on long ago. Have invited you on because of this terrific article that you wrote in response to a New York Times op-ed by Bishop Desmond Tutu, someone with whom I believe you, as well as I, usually tend to agree. But Desmond Tutu's argument was that African nations should be supporting the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and should not be accusing it of bias and racism. What's wrong with that argument?
The International Criminal Court is a really politicized institution. I don't think anybody should cooperate with it. I think it, since it's politicized, it means that it's enforcing unequal justice, and unequal justice is not justice. So, and in fact, one of the interesting things about the court, in the book I wrote with Peterson called The Politics of Genocide, we mentioned that through 2009, the ICC had only indicted at 14 black Africans, nobody outside of Africa. So it, and even, and in Africa too, the ICC did not go after Kagame in Rwanda or Museveni in Uganda, but they happen to be U.S. clients. But they also are huge war criminals. They invaded the Democratic Republic of the Congo. In the course of that invasion, they killed literally millions of people. But they've not been attacked at all by the ICC. So with respect to Africa, the bias has been blatant. So and unequal justice, as I say, is not justice. I think the Africans should steer clear of the International Court.
If the International Criminal Court were truly international and unbiased and blind and equal in distribution of justice, do you think there would be prosecutions of leaders in the United States and Western nations over Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen? Would those all be criminal cases?
If you had a real justice system, absolutely. I mean, the United States has invaded country after country, violated the UN Charter on a regular basis. It now has really essentially declared the whole world as a free fire zone. We have special ops corps that are everywhere. The Iraq case was really a truly dramatic case. I mean, in Iraq, we carried out these sanctions of mass destruction from 1991 onward. In one of my favorite episodes in modern history, in 1996, Madeleine Albright was asked by a CBS reporter, it's alleged that 500,000 children have died as a result of these sanctions. Was that worth it? And Madeleine Albright said, yes, it was worth it. Here you have the U.S. Secretary of State admitting that 500,000 children had possibly been killed as a result of mainly U.S.-imposed sanctions, and it was worth it. I mean, there is criminal action beyond anything you would have in Yugoslavia. But although the later than the invasion of Iraq involved maybe another million deaths and 4 million refugees. So the package for the United States in Iraq would be hard to match. And the British went along with us, and we've violated the UN Charter in other cases. So I think that maybe the number one people who should be in the dock are the leaders of the United States over the last 20 years.
You know, I ran into Madeleine Albright just last year with a video camera and asked her about that comment, and she said that she had long since apologized for making that comment, but not for that policy. And I asked about current sanctions on Iran and whether she'd learned her lesson, and she said, oh no, I support those fully. So these are indeed habitual criminals to be indicted were there a justice system. But Bishop Tutu makes several arguments against the idea of bias in the ICC, and one is that there were separate tribunals set up for several places, including Yugoslavia and Rwanda, that indicted non-Africans that are not part of that total because they were separate special tribunals. What is your response?
Well, for one thing, it doesn't really answer the question, because If the crimes that all we're talking about with Madeleine Albright and Clinton and that gang in Iraq run into the millions, why shouldn't they be indicted, whatever happened for other special cases? But Tutu, I don't think, knows what was going on in, for example, Yugoslavia, where you had a tribunal created by the Security Council, but essentially by the United States. And that it was actually ultra vires. There was no authority on the part of the Security Council to create a judicial body. But they did it, and they enforced it against whom? The Serbs. The United States, it was quite clear from 1992-93 when this organization was put together that it was to go after the bad guys from the U.S. standpoint, namely the Serbs. It was quite clear from the beginning that the intent was to use that tribunal to keep a war going or make it possible to carry out a war. It was used to prevent peace negotiations from being successful in Yugoslavia from 1993 on. So it was really a war-making effort, and that tribunal really essentially served as a public relations false judicial arm of NATO. So it was not an organization that worked in the interest of justice. It was really a U.S. war instrument.
Same
thing was true of the Rwanda tribunal. That also was a creation of the United States. Albright vetted all the prosecutors for the two tribunals. She gave them the approval. She knew they would do what she wanted, and they did. So that in Rwanda, for example, I mentioned that the United States State Department had an internal memorandum in December 1994 that indicated that Kagame and his forces were killing 10,000 Hutus a month, civilian Hutus, not warriors. They didn't do a darn thing about it. But the interesting thing about the tribunal, in the Rwanda tribunal, is no member of Kagame's forces have ever been brought to trial. It's strictly going after Kagame's enemies. So, it's a farcical tribunal.
Bishop Tutu also goes back to post-World War II prosecutions. But there, Nuremberg and Tokyo, was not the very same bias evident?
Yes. Oh, yes. That was the victor's justice. Maybe it was problematical from that viewpoint, but that was a victory over a really vicious pair of states and criminals. So it was selective justice, but one can defend it maybe a defensible victor's justice. But in the case of Rwanda and Yugoslavia, it was victor's justice in the case of Rwanda, but it was not justifiable justice. It was it's a long story, but I believe that Kagame and the RPF, with U.S. support, were the main criminals in all the killing in Rwanda. So it was not justice at all. It was another ugly, dirty business. And in the case of Yugoslavia, as I was mentioning, that tribunal was used to keep things hot, to prevent peace, which is completely contrary to what the Security Council and Chapter 7 are supposed to be doing. So they manufactured evil there. And again, I think the worst criminals in the Yugoslavia war case were Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Tony Blair. I think Milosevic was really a patsy.
So if selective justice, if partial justice can be better than nothing, then does Bishop Desmond Tutu have a case that even if the International Criminal Court is giving free rein to crime in the rest of the world, that justice in Africa is better than nothing, and that there are African leaders who really do want immunity for crimes and really do find it convenient to call the ICC racist, even if it's true?
Well, I believe that biased justice, selective justice, is not justice. So I would be opposed to cooperating with them on the grounds that this is an institution that's deeply politicized from the word go, and it's not one, therefore, that we should cooperate with. But also, as I mentioned, it's very selective in Africa, too. So U.S. supported the big criminals like Kagame and Museveni are not subject to the authority of the court. So where you have the selective justice, there's no assurance that you're getting real criminals. And it also, by focusing on lesser criminals, it maybe lets the big criminals get away with more murder. They look like they're pursuing justice when, in fact, they're just clearing the ground for doing more of their own dirty work.
You wrote in your article that Bishop Tutu seemed unaware of the U.S. presence now in Africa, with AFRICOM moving into at least 35 countries.
Yes, I think I think that was a correct statement, and I think the guy who said that was right on target. What has happened is that the United States has supported Kagame and Museveni in the occupation of the Congo with enormous deaths, and the ICC has collaborated in that, and they also collaborated with the United States in removing Gaddafi. One of the important things about Gaddafi, he was obviously not a perfect and democratic leader, although in the African, the Middle East context, he doesn't look bad at all. But Gaddafi was put very high ranking in getting Africa more independent. He was instrumental in organizing the African Union. He was its first head, and he put a lot of money into the various institutions in Africa. He was all in favor of them having their own monetary fund, an investment bank, and judicial institutions. And so he was, in his last few years, he was pushing for a United States of Africa. It's a phrase he used. He wanted Africa to become more powerful and able to bargain and serve its own interests. So his removal has actually been a terrible thing for African unity, and it's part and parcel, this new surge of AFRICOM and the United States on a global basis. We're now more powerful in Africa, and it all fits into an ugly pattern.
We're speaking with Edward Herman, who has a monthly article in Z Magazine, and the latest is about this topic of the ICC and Africa. So, Ed Herman, how is it that the United States manages to control the ICC? Through what mechanisms does this happen? Is it through the veto power? Is it through appointments? Is it through influence of various sorts? How does this non-member nation, the United States of America, manage to exercise such control over a supposedly international institution that it doesn't belong to?
It controls it because the United States is so important in the world and has been serving for so long as the enforcement agency, an international policeman, and it's so powerful and so it is so desired by the people that organize the ICC that the United States should participate. That they made tremendous concessions in fixing the rules of the ICC. The most important thing that they did was they did not include in the crimes that could be pursued by the ICC, they didn't include aggression, or that they made it a special Section 5 in which it was to be fixed later. It was when they could figure out a definition and the conditions for enforcement, and even then it wouldn't happen for at least 7 years, and until seven-eighths of the countries sanction it. And even then, it would not be applicable to countries that refuse to accept its jurisdiction. So aggression was thrown out in forming the ICC, and they did this quite explicitly because the United States otherwise wouldn't possibly join. So they were trying to bribe the United States as they formulated the damn thing. And they made it inherently ineffective and something that would not apply to an aggressor state. Aggression, aggression is U.S. business, and the United States doesn't want aggression to be a international criminal court could deal with. So they fixed it so it would not be a crime. And this happened because they were eager to get the United States in. It's a powerful country. It's the one that has enforced international law in these for these organizations. So the United States played it cool and wouldn't go along and cause them actually to put in another section. I think it's called 98 Section 5, which allows countries to enter into agreements with other countries to not abide by the International Criminal Court and to not submit prisoners if the International Criminal Court wants them. These are bilateral agreements. The United States has made them with a couple of dozen countries, which is completely, of course, contrary to the spirit of the criminal court to bargain for the exemption of the United States from coughing up criminals. Why does the United States do this? Because we're ultra-sensitive to whether our boys can be tried in foreign courts. It doesn't even matter whether they're guilty. So we even passed an act called satirically called the Invade Hague Act, where the Congress of the United States passed this law, which says that if anybody takes possession of any American official or troops under the ICC, the United States government should take whatever means it needs to, including the use of force, to get those people out. So if these people are in The Hague, we should invade the Netherlands to take them back. Anyway, it's a little grotesque, but the United States is very sensitive. We want to stay outside the law for our people, but we want to be able to enforce the law. So we've used the ICC against our targets, but we won't join the organization. And the main reason, I think, is that we don't want international law to apply to us, and it might for the ICC, which has many members, and where a country could go out, sue the United States and ask for the coughing up of U.S. people who carried out crimes.
Us and we, of course, referring to the U.S. government, not necessarily you or me or listeners to this program who might support international justice. So what is the answer? Can the United States be moved to take part in a legitimate international law enforcement effort to which it is subject as everyone else? Can that be the International Criminal Court, or need it be something else? Or is the whole enterprise of international law forever hopeless?
Well, the first thing that we should try to do is to get the United States to abide by the UN Charter. All our efforts in modern times have been to escape from the UN Charter, which is a charter essentially condemning cross-border attacks, that is to say, aggression. So I think the first order of business for Americans is to get the United States to behave in accordance with the UN Charter, to not aggress. That would be a huge change. So, and in fact, I think, broadly speaking, the main thing the American people should try to do to make for international justice would be to get the United States to disarm, to stop the arms race. With the death of the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact dissolved, but NATO keeps expanding. And the United States has been more aggressive since the death of the Soviet Union than before. So it seems to me that the main thing we have to do to cause the world to be more peaceable and more lawful is to get the United States to behave properly, to adhere to the existing body of law.
You know, the United Nations is drafting reports now that try to distinguish legitimate uses of drones going into other nations to murder people from illegitimate, with very vague and limited success, but essentially erasing the UN Charter in UN reports. A UN Charter which, nonetheless, in any case, legitimizes any war that is labeled defensive or is authorized by the United Nations. What would you think of getting the United States to comply with the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which doesn't rely on any definition of aggression, but rather forbids war?
I think that would be terrific. But there are all the peace agreements like that one and the UN Charter are things that the United States should be abiding by. And that would be a huge step toward international justice.
How can we get there? Wow, how can we move people in the United States to demand that?
Well, that's a big question. How we need more programs like yours, David. Many, many more. We need programs like websites like Stop NATO, which is a very good one. It's a question just of educating and organizing. The left, the anti-war faction, is kind of weak in the United States. I mean, the first order of business of anybody, of you and I and all the rest of our lives is to educate people and give them the truth on what the United States has done and what the law is and that should be enforced, and to fight against the arms, the permanent war system. That would involve electing representatives who would support a sane arms policy.
Well, I greatly appreciate all of your tremendous work over the years and in recent weeks toward that end. We've been speaking with Edward Herman. He's a professor emeritus of finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and you should read his regular Fog Watch column in the monthly Z magazine. Ed Herman, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.